When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Sick of being upsold at gyms?
My guy, you're currently a base member. For $90 more, I can upgrade you to our Shred membership. For $130 more, you'll be a swole member. And for just $300 more, you'll reach Sweat Platinum.
At Planet Fitness, you'll get energy without the upsell. Never pushy, always free fitness training and equipment for every workout. It's fitness that fits your budget. Join Planet Fitness for just $1 down and $10 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, May 10th. See Home Club for details.
In 1974, I got to know Donal Lunny and Micheál O'Donnell, who are working on production with several albums we were doing for Gaelin, namely Trina's solo album, an album by Paddy Keenan, and indeed the second album by Clannad. And from there we got the idea of forming a company to market the recordings by the Bothy Band, which they themselves were forming at that moment. I think the initial concept that maybe we would do a recording under the Gaelin label, but when we investigated the situation, we found that it would be possible to start a complete record company based on the recording, the kind of material that we had done up to then, that they had produced up to then, producing the Bothy Band recordings and going ahead and doing solo albums by the various members and other musicians that both Donal and Micheál felt were worthy of being recorded. Donal had worked for many years with various international record companies. He felt that the terms offered to himself and to other musicians were very restrictive. He felt he'd like to see more freedom in the studio, more ease at selecting the material. He also wished that he could be in a position to record certain artists that he actually saw himself and heard. And if you're not working with your own record company, you've got to virtually hawk this material around. So in that way, like Mulligan as a company itself was able to do all of these things. Well, I felt it was a great idea. I mean, I still do. Obviously, there were a lot of difficulties and shortcomings in our approach to the whole thing, which only emerged after several years of working that system. But the principle of allowing certain musicians, like Donal and the Bothy Band, more freedom to create their music in the studio was a very good idea.
Checking out the various record companies to see who'd give us a deal, and Gaelin were interested, but we felt we wanted to sort of, I suppose, remain neutral, feeling that there was enough Irish content in the music of the album anyway, without say having the cover in Irish or whatever. That was one reason why we didn't go with Gwilym, I suppose. And other companies, I don't suppose we would have had too much trouble getting a deal at the time. But anyway, I don't know exactly who brought up the idea of forming the label itself, but Micheál, Seamus and myself decided to have a go at it and give ourselves a generous percentage through discussions and trying to plan things. We had maybe a very idealistic approach to what we could do for musicians and bands and whatever in terms of the deal, in terms of our conditions, the contract which they would have with the company. One of the significant ones was that the company paid for recording costs, and that's generally not done. Usually what happens is a record company will advance the artist enough money to pay for the recording costs, and sometimes more money than will, you know, so there's some left over. But what you're actually doing is getting your share of the profits on the album in advance, and it's only when sort of several hundred thousand albums have been sold that you actually start getting more money back from it. But in effect, you pay for it yourself.
There you heard two of the founder directors of the Mulligan Recording Company, Seamus O'Neill and Donal Lunny. The third man involved with Mulligan at its inception was Micheál O'Donnell, now living in America. He, along with Donal Lunny, was a founder member of the Bothy Band. Also involved with Mulligan in its early days was PJ Curtis. PJ managed and travelled with the Bothy Band, subsequently joined the company, and went on to produce several albums for the label.
The whole idea about Mulligan was that it was to be a kind of a cooperative where the people that that came along to record for Mulligan would have a large say in how they presented their sound, so that they wouldn't have some A&R man coming along to say, you have to record in this studio, you have to record with these musicians, and that at the end of the day that they had artistic control taken away from them, which most artists that record for the major labels at the time, or even the minor labels in Ireland, had little or no say in the final product. And that the whole idea, the philosophy behind Mulligan was that the artists should have some say in the final product, which after all, they were the ones that were creating the music. And so the idea was that Mulligan was there as, if you like, an instrument by which the artists could have a lot of say in the production of their own material, both pre-studio and in-studio. And then that Mulligan would release the albums, and that profits would find their way back to the artists.
The contractual situation was also constructed in favour of the artist rather than the record company. And
could you explain how that was the case?
Well, it's probably difficult to explain, in as much as it's usually the small print in contracts that are the most devastating as far as artists go. I think the main difference was in the interpretation of the contracts. In other words, in studio time, allowing complete artistic freedom, not going ahead and producing something that the artist was not totally happy with. In other words, making sure, regardless of the cost possibly, that the product, the end product, the end master recording, was as close as possible to what the artist wished it to be. Apart from the actual contractual situation, at the time there were very few companies interested in giving bands like the Bothy Band in Ireland and musicians like Mick Hanley a recording contract, or even entering into any kind of deal with them to record their material. most deals that were done by international companies with very restrictive contracts. A lot of this material was subsequently deleted or would not be available anymore. So Mulligan had the advantage of being here in Ireland, seeing the groups and wanting to make records of these people. I obviously administered the company, did all the groundwork related to the running of the company. And this included copyright details. Now, Donal and Micheál, their function, they were directors of the company, was mainly to produce records, obviously to recommend recordings that Mulligan should do, to possibly supervise recordings where they weren't themselves producing, and to take an active part in the actual production of the material. Now, I also would have recommended recordings, but the early recordings that Mulligan did, I think mainly were done at the request or at the suggestion of people like Micheál and Donal.
Mulligan established its headquarters at 101 Temple Oak Road in Dublin. As well as housing the company's offices, it was also home to several musicians who wrote and recorded for the label.
We took over the house first. The musicians came afterwards. Micheál, I think, decided to move in and work from there. And as time went on, we had other tenants, musicians mainly, who came and took up a flat or stayed in the house itself. We had also a muse at the back, which we had intended turning into a studio or pressing plant. But when it became obvious that we couldn't go ahead with this, we moved the offices to the muse at the back and left the house as a residence for these musicians. There was certainly a lot of activity. Most nights of the week, there were musicians calling to see one or other of the musicians who were there. People came from abroad that the Bothy Band had met on tour. Invariably, they came with sleeping bags and would be still there today, I think, only that we had to close down the operation. But we had a lot of good friends and indeed a lot of hangers-on at the time, and there was always something happening in Mulligan. Like, I think the house in Temple Oak Road was the place where most musicians retreated to after gigs in town or whatever was going on at the time.
Early one morning the fair maid arose and dressed herself up in the finest of clothes, and off to the shoemaker's shop so she goes for a kiss in the morning early. The cobbler arose and he soon let her in. His awl and his hammer were neat as a pin, and he had the will for to greet her so slim with the kiss in the morning early.
Micheál vacated his flat and I moved in, and I lived there for about, a year or something, 2 years. So it was just simply by being in that circle that I had a chat with Micheál one night, and he was saying he was moving out or something, and I said I'd love to take over the room, and there was great activity going on. Like, the place was full of musicians. I think Red Peters was in downstairs. Kathy Moore was living there, and she was doing batiks, and she was part of the Pumpkinhead. Who else is there? Oh, PJ Curtis was living there. Jimmy Faulkner. PJ had all his music there. So it was a hive of activity. There was always something happening. It's very hard to get the bed in the house. I remember one master session there of Paddy Glacken and Paddy Keenan, which went on to tape, and which was stolen. That was the best session I was ever at, I'd say.
I certainly would have spent a lot of time up there, yeah, sort of visiting there, talking to, say, well, like when Michal was living up there, there were a lot of sessions there at night. PJ Curtis lived there. It was very much a centre. Say, when I put this description on it, that, like, if Mulligan were a religion, which of course it wouldn't be quite, well, then Mulligan Mansions, which was the christening that I gave it, would have been its mosque.
The whole thing about Mulligan was that the offices were, yes, in 101 Temple Oak Road, people lived there as well, musicians lived there, and the offices were there. So it was like a collective where 24 hours a day there was a company of people that were involved in a very creative work of talking about music, being involved in it. So it wasn't just like going into an office 9 to 5. It was a 24-hour...
You lived there too, didn't you?
Yes, I lived there. In fact, it was amazing. I remember at one stage in the basement, Red Peters was living downstairs. Jimmy Faulkner, who's now at Hot Foot, he was living downstairs in the basement. Willie Matthews, who did a lot of our covers and artwork, an American, he was living down the basement. The offices were in the middle floor. And then upstairs, Mick Hanley was living upstairs. Michal O'Donnell, I was living up there. David Hanley was living up there for a while when he was finishing off his novel. And Cathy Moore, who used to be with Pumpkinhead. And so I remember one particular day that downstairs rehearsing were the Floating Dublin Blues Band. In the middle section of the house, the Bothy Band were rehearsing. And upstairs, there was various members of Midnight Well rehearsing. And down the back, then later on that night, we had a little muse down the back. The Boomtown Rats were just beginning to form and rehearse, and I remember Cathy Moore and myself kind of sneaking down and eavesdropping on this group that were there rehearsing, and their leader coming in making cups of tea and saying that they were going to get to number one and that they were really going to make it. And I remember Cathy Moore saying, that guy, whoever he is, he's really going to take that band to
really?
Get something, to get somewhere. And of course he turns out to be young Bob Geldof.
Before we moved into it, we had used the Muse as a rehearsal room for various groups. And that was where we came in contact with Bob Geldof and the Boomtown Rats.
Tell me a bit about that.
Well, I had been asked if I could make the place available for rehearsals for the band, because they were finding it difficult getting a place that was quiet in the first instance for them, and also that their music wouldn't be intruding and annoying neighbours. So we allow them use the Muse for a period of months while they made up a demo which they intended selling to an international company. They were quite positive they were going to get this international deal, but they were also certain, because of their relationship with us and because we had given them this kind of facility, that they would like Mulligan to issue their records in Ireland. So while they were doing a deal for the world, they excluded Ireland, which they then gave to Mulligan. Well, we had obviously the first single they did, Looking After Number One, and their first, second and third albums. And then the Rats themselves altered their international deal, and the rights in Ireland went to WEA. With a group like the Rats, a lot of money is required for promotion. And while singles like I Don't Like Mondays sold in excess of 40,000 copies, we still lost money on that, because there was so much money spent on promotion that we ended up, I think, in the end, by having lost money on the deal. You do have to have world distribution to be able to get some money back out of an act like the Boomtown Rats.
Again, if you look at the catalogue, there's everything from rock to just what is completely straight traditional. That was Bobby Casey's one. And I suppose it's because of that time, like, you might put it down to Sean O'Rea, the Planxty, all those times. Rock musicians and traditional musicians were sort of rubbing shoulder to shoulder late at night, sort of sometimes very late at night, perhaps if I can say that, in places like the Meeting Place. And the catalogue, it covers all those different things from, say, Gay and Terry Woods, Deke O'Brien, that was Nightbus, I think was the name of his band, right to this one of Bobby Casey. And Micheál's idea, I think it was that there would be a section of the catalogue devoted to just pure traditional music. A very good idea, but I don't think there was any other records besides this one, which was the one that I did, Bobby Casey's one. I suppose I knew Bobby a bit, and I suppose because I did produce some other records, like for Gaelin, and that, I suppose I had perhaps the right qualifications. It involved talking to him, arranging a date. We recorded in Harry Bradshaw's house, which is probably a good idea because, you know, if you're doing it in a studio, you're talking about, I don't know, well, £30 or £40 an hour, but Harry would be much more flexible about what time, but yes, he had equipment, etc., etc., that made a very good record. And, like, perfect sound quality in that, just what you need, and maybe that informal atmosphere, which, you know, some traditional musicians like that, when they go into a big place like Windmill, that they feel slightly intimidated, if just by something that looks like the cockpit of an aircraft. He had a long lineage from West Clare. I think his father was a man called Scully Casey, who had a lot of music that only was found down there, and that's in the tradition of sort of Garrett Barry, Willie Clancy, John Kelly, that particular region music, which is a strong one. And Bobby has been in London for 30 years, but when you listen to him play, you hear all of West Clare, so he's very authentic. He has those tunes from there, and he is a very good player.
Peter Brown talking about the Bobby Casey album Taking Flight, which he produced in 1979. Peter himself played pipes on three albums released by Mulligan.
One was Mick Hanley's one, that was the Kiss in the Morning. Or there were two hornpipes on that, and one of them, I think, is a version. They're both versions of Shan Van Vocht, and Mick found them in different places, and I played the pipes on that. Kevin Burke's album, If the Calf Fits, there's a big long track of 15 or 16 reels, which I remember, it doesn't have any title at all. I remember calling it The Loneliness of the Long Distance Fiddler, because it goes on for 16 minutes. And I played a reel on this called The Hunter's Purse. It's somewhere around the middle. And I remember I was to play the flute in it, because Kevin, well, I used to play the flute a bit with Kevin sometimes, and he liked the style that I had. But when I came in that night, I had the pipes case with me, and I said, can I just try the pipes on it? And he said, oh yeah, and I did it, and it worked really well, because I remember afterwards Kevin said in that accent that he has something, he said, yeah, this is really going to become a record now, or something like that. And then the other one is the first record that Scullion ever made. Scullion's, what you might call their folk album. And on this, I think I played on about three or four. I played the whistle on some and the flute on another one called Domes, I remember. And at the back end, there's a sort of a musical tag onto a song that Sonny got called The Fruit Smelling Shop. Just I think he was sitting at the piano, he told me, and he was reading Joyce. And the print more or less came off the page and into his hands. He put that paragraph to music, but he said he felt himself, I think, to be just sort of like a medium for it, that it was all there done from almost. At the back end of that, there is a piece of music with the pipes and the saxophone together, and we seem to think that was the first time that the pipes and the saxophone were ever matched together. Not the last, obviously. And I can remember this much about it, that Sonny, the pipes piece was laid down, and Sonny then was doing the sax, as it were, to sort of answer it and sort of weave round of it. And he did it once or twice, and it was okay. And he came out and he listened. I think he didn't like it. He went back in again, and he did what was a brilliant one. And everyone was saying, well, that is it. The second Boffy Band album is called Old Hag You've Killed Me. That's a jig, I think, that Willie Clancy had, the Chailleach do Mhairis Mé. But the band had been playing at the Cambridge Folk Festival, I think, just when this, just after the album had been recorded. It was recorded, I think, in a place in Wales called Rockfield. And I had been playing myself with them for about 6 weeks just before that. But when they came back from Cambridge, and it was a matter of finding a title for an album, that's always a difficult thing to do. Apparently, the conventional wisdom within the band was that it should be called Is There a Bar on Mars? Now, that's an odd enough title, you might think, for a traditional album. But then, on the other hand, the counter-argument to that was that since Irish music and rock music were coming very close together at that time, and in something like the Boffy Band, that maybe a sort of a zany title was a good thing. But I think there may have been actual threats to leave by at least one person if it wasn't changed. The objections being that there's a certain drink association with Irish music, perhaps, and the idea being that if the Boffy Band were going out to play on Mars, the first question would be asked would be, where's the nearest pub or something like that.
Yeah. within a few years of setting up, Mulligan had built up an impressive catalogue of records which represented the best of Irish contemporary folk and traditional music. It remained nonetheless a small company, operating for the most part on small budgets, but always aiming for the highest standards possible in the recording and production of albums. Financial pressures were, as a result, constant and unrelenting, and were ultimately to lead the company into conflict with its own musicians.
I would say that I had an idealistic attitude towards that, because I would want to record something as best we could, regardless of what it cost. Well, it was obviously a consideration. I mean, we had budgets, but I didn't consider them my problem, and I wasn't involved in the, say, the business administration of the company. Seamus O'Neill looked after that, but I treated it as a sort of an open situation, and generally speaking, we managed to record things as we thought they should be recorded, and to spend enough time on them. And Seamus handled the problem of making ends meet.
I didn't get paid at the time, but I sort of fixed a fee in my own mind, at least. And I never broached the matter, because I, you know, a lot of the time, if you don't really need money, I suppose, if the wolf isn't really at the door, you'll sort of wait for a while and perhaps sort of mention it quietly to someone of that. But it went on a very long finger. So I remember I left RTE, I went to London. I was living there for a while, and from London I decided to go to France, and I had no money at all. And suddenly I thought to myself, well, now I never got this money. It was £200 I decided was a suitable figure. So I sent a letter to Mulligan, to Seamus O'Neill, and said, could you send over this now, because I'm really, I don't have a lot, I'm skint. So there was no answer came, and maybe with about a week or 4 days to go before I go to off to France, I said, it's not coming, I'll ring him. And I rang, and he wasn't there, and Nell was there, and she said that he was gone to the bank, actually, as it happened, and that she'd leave a message. So I really thought at this stage, no, I'd be lucky to get it. But when Seamus did ring back, and he said to me that he had gotten the letter, and I said, well, what did you do when you got it? And he said to me, well, I did a thing that is quite customary to do when you get demands for money. And I said, what's that? And he said, nothing. So I said, like, Seamus, if you can manage it, I really would appreciate it. So to his eternal credit, and as I give him public gratitude here, that he sent off the money by some form of express, not only in Irish punt, but actually in sterling, £200, and I took it to a bank, some special bank in the centre of London, in like Threadneedle Street or something, walked in and changed it and came out feeling that
a richer man
and decidedly the smile, a wider smile.
Well, the albums were promoted in all kinds of ways. This was one of the difficulties. We spent a lot of time in and a lot of effort in producing the material, in getting the recorded material to the highest possible standards. And then when the album came out and was in the sleeve, and the album was fine and the sleeve was fine, we didn't really seem to have very much clout in promoting. We didn't have the money to promote, because all the money was being ploughed into the production of the album. And I remember when the Midnight Well album came out, and I was it was my job to see that the thing was promoted. If I remember correctly, I think my promotion budget for promoting the Midnight Well album was in the region of £18, and I spent the £18 on little posters and stuck them around town. The way that we promoted was footwork. We just assumed that the record was so good that everybody was going to snatch it up and start talking about it, which they did. But it wasn't exactly the way that a major record company would have promoted an album such as a Midnight Well album.
Of something that's yet to come, I get a feeling telling me what's undone. When I find out you don't love me, honey, when I find out you're going away, you know, surprise, 'cause I
I saw that there was a lot of dissatisfaction in certain quarters from musicians that didn't... I was also on the ground talking to musicians and out with musicians, and there was a lot of unhappy musicians around that thought that they should be getting back perhaps royalty payments that they weren't getting back, and I don't know, it just seemed to me that the core, the central core of what Mulligan was all about was beginning to implode on itself. It just began to lose the impetus and the creative buzz that was around in 76 and 77. And maybe it was the natural way of all things that it just had two great years, and then things began to go wrong very subtly.
It fell out upon one Martinmas time, when snow lay on the border, there came a troop of soldiers here to take up their winter quarters. And they blowed north and they blowed south, and they blowed o'er the border. And there they met with a nice little girl, and she was a farmer's daughter. And they made her swear a solemn oath, with the salt tear in her eye, oh, that she would come to the quarter gates when no one did her spy, oh.
I have absolutely no regrets. I do regret it, but I'm slightly angry about the fact that I've received no statement or royalty from Mulligan in at least 6 years. It angers me when I see the album on sale through Polydor here or through Greenland America. It angers me to think that it's an ongoing situation, that I'm not going to get any money. Seamus's big thing was to build up a catalogue. That was the first thing to do, was to build up a catalogue, to like put all the money into material, which he did very well. But I think a lot of the albums which sold, for instance, like the Bothy Band albums or the album I made with Paul Brady, very much supported other records which, as somebody said the other day, appeared without trace. But I don't think you could call it a musician's company when nobody got their just dues from it. It was nice. Had it been a success and had it been run correctly, then it would have been absolutely great. It would have been perfect. I do remember from a very early position, even before the company was set up, there was talk about buying studio equipment and having its own studio, which at the time seemed a lofty and fine idea, but in retrospect was perhaps a symptom of the lack of reality on which it was founded. You know.
By 1980, Mulligan was receiving financial assistance from the Arts Council. Paddy Glacken was traditional music officer for the council at that time.
I think the standards that Mulligan set, I think, were particularly high. That's reflected, I suppose, in records like the Bothy Band records. And I think, overall, I think it was a very, very worthwhile venture. I think it's a pity, though, that the artistic standards weren't matched by the business standards. It got itself into situations which it just couldn't cope with. I think it overestimated the market for traditional music. And I think that the company got itself involved in deals which it wasn't able to honour. Well, we looked into their sales, obviously, because again, of the arrangements which Mulligan had entered into with the council. The sales were not good. But then again, you know, they weren't good for the Irish, for records in general. And I think basically what happened is that, as I said earlier, I think Mulligan just overestimated the size of the market. Well, there was a certain ideal involved insofar as they were trying to achieve the highest artistic standards, and in the case of the Bothy Band, I think they did achieve that, but obviously to the detriment of the business side of things. I think it just goes to prove that musicians are notoriously bad business people.
And I suppose the fact that Mulligan still exists today, that the company hasn't gone into liquidation, that it's still there, is evidence of the fact that, that we have managed to override most of these problems. I say we're there today. We haven't obviously done any production in the last 3 or 4 years, but we hope to get back to doing this in the not-too-distant future.
What is in the future for Mulligan? What kind of a company will it be?
Well, I would think, obviously, on the same lines as it was originally, with a view to recording the kind of music we had done in the beginning, specialist music, music that doesn't have a high commercial element to it. But obviously we will take the mistakes we had made and look at them very carefully and make sure that it doesn't happen again. These obviously would be in the realms of overspending on production, getting involved in recordings which, at the end of the day, we weren't able to use for one reason or another due to temperamental artists or whatever else. I think we will make sure that whatever we get involved in, wherever we invest our money, that at the end of the day we will have a product which we can sell.
If you take out the albums and listen to the albums that Mulligan produced, they're still the cream of that 70s period. And I think that it was a one-off experiment. I can see it working under present-day conditions, you know, the way the economy is and people's minds are in a different space at the moment. I think it was just one of those rare occurrences that happened. It was the right time, the right place, there was the right mixture of musicians, the right feelings amongst musicians, the right energies were being released, the right creative energies, the right ideas all came together and worked.
Well, I would think that it was probably one of the foremost Irish labels that existed from 1975 upwards to 1980. I think the quality of our productions, our presentation, and the content of the catalogue was hard to surpass. And I think it also inspired a lot of other record companies to follow suit and to get into the same kind of production that we were in those years. It also inspired, I think, international companies to look more closely at Irish music and to produce some very fine records from it.
I went through periods of resentment, I suppose, at the fact that that it wasn't more successful financially, and that in the end I didn't really make any money out of it, having put a lot of time into it. But the payoff is the music, and the fact that it did add a certain impetus to the development of Irish music recording at the time, and may have influenced the situation as it is today, which is very good. It doesn't look as likely to happen again now, but that's not to say that it won't. I think that Dublin is becoming a centre of music in world terms. There's no doubt about that. Like the quality of the studios that are here now are equal to none. You know, I mean, they're second to none, really. And there are many alternatives for people who come here to record. I think that given the quality of studios that are around and the life that's in the recording business at the moment, that it is possible that something like that might happen again. It depends really on what kind of focus comes on Ireland as a source of music in world terms. But it could happen.